What's up, everyone? This is the Next Tape Podcast with Mikhail and...
And Janika.
This is episode 26, I believe. Yeah. And we have a special guest on this episode. Would you like to introduce him, Tanika?
Yes, I would. So we have Tristan Stewart Robertson, who is the host of a podcast called A Murder Without End, which I personally highly recommend. But Tristan, you can say hi.
Hi. Thank you for listening.
Yeah. So if you haven't heard of A Murder Without End, it's available on all podcast platforms. I don't want to give anything away with it. This story is a crazy one. It's a one that goes on for many, many years. And definitely helped me learn something actually about the laws within Scotland, actually, and how crazy that is. Like, if someone flees there, you might be able to stay there.
Interesting.
And I don't want to say much more than that, but it's a great podcast.
And I appreciate that.
You're welcome. Yeah, no, I definitely said I was going to listen to it, and I did, and I got through like every episode within a day. I couldn't stop listening. It was nice. Really good.
the brother of one of the victims plowed through it in about a day.
Yeah.
Then came back and said that he wished there was more. And I thought it took 5 years to produce that podcast. So I thought, no, there's really not more.
I mean, thank God that there isn't, honestly, just because it took almost 20 years to get him back to Florida. So it's, you know, it's unfortunately something has to come to an end with these types of stories, but this is one that lasted for so long, and I've never heard of anything like, I've never heard of this case before. So it's amazing that I've never heard of this before. And so it was very good.
Thank you.
Yeah. Pretty interesting.
Yeah. I know Mikhail's on interjuke.
So, not really into true crime, but I like to listen, educate myself.
This one's
on
a little different.
So I basically,
it's not just focused on the murder itself. So you might like this podcast. I'm just saying.
Although I tag it as true crime, I view it as somewhat different myself.
It is, yeah.
Because I don't. I didn't focus too much on the gory details of the crime. I know there's a lot of true crime podcasts that do that, and there's a lot of ones that are just almost conversational, or, you know, chatting about a crime over alcohol. Those ones don't appeal to me at all. You know, give me a bit of journalism to it. I'm obviously biased as a reporter. I think that true crime is a very broad category.
It is.
Are you more story based or more informational?
The podcast is probably it's information, but it is with a narrative. You know, I took lessons from narrative journalism because I needed to be able to pull people in and keep their attention for 9 episodes. There's a whole episode that some people wanted me to drop, which was about 10 years worth of court cases, but I couldn't really do that. It was essential information. Oh, wow. So it took a few times, a few script versions to get it to a state that would carry you through very technical information, but I felt that I needed to include that because that's part a key part of the story.
I agree. Yeah, I don't see how you could have dropped that because that is an important part of bringing the person who did this to justice. So I couldn't have imagined it happening any other way than it did. Yes, I know the court case stuff, the legal aspect of things can be maybe boring for some. Like, it's not for me because this is what I do the living to.
Sure.
It's what I went to school for, so this interests me. But for others, it maybe doesn't. But to this case, it's so important to include that because this person prolonged purposely, I believe, to keep him and himself in Scotland because he didn't want to face justice in Florida. So, I don't see how it could have gone any other way with the storytelling.
I should have summarized what the, without giving anything away, the basic story is about a murder in Florida in 1999 that leads to a tragedy in Scotland, to one of the longest extradition battles in British legal history. Ultimately the story about the mum of that victim and her fight for justice over a very long time.
Yes. Yeah.
So in that sense, I consider it also far more victim focused than
a lot of podcasts.
I think a lot of true crime content, TV, audio, what print is focused on the killer. It's focused on the act of murder, as opposed to
that's the victim.
Yep.
That's true.
Yeah.
100%.
And that's kind of ten like the podcast that I listen to. Like I listen to like Morbid or there's another one that I listen to that Crime Junkie. Those ones are so much more victim based. Especially True Crime Junkie, because she actually has done a lot of help to solve cold cases or anything like that. So it is a lot more victim-based, I find, with those. And those are the ones I try to tend to stay towards. Sometimes you might get a podcast that obviously is more geared to focusing on the killer. But as long as I feel like there is this kind of balance that you're focusing on the victim, or you yourself, the listener, is taking in those names and have those ones that last and live with you, which is in my case, there are cases that live with me that I will never forget. And that's kind of my way of focusing more on the victim than focusing on the killer. So I think it's also just you as a person and how you take in true crime, if you are a true crime fan.
No, I think it depends on it depends on the case as well. There are cases, particularly if you've got an unsolved case, you are going to focus more maybe on the evidence that there is and what you need to go through to try to work out what happened. In the case of my podcast, it is a single gunshot. That's not giving anything away. Single gunshot that starts this. There's not that much in the way of forensics or anything like that. And so you can sort of leave that really to the side and focus much more on what happens after that and the impact on the people left behind, which is the big thing for me, in that any crime has an impact that lasts well beyond the single gunshot.
Okay.
Okay.
So basically with this particular episode, which we kind of have kind of started talking about, is we're going to kind of talk about the obsession with true crime, and we are kind of going to focus more on serial killers and stuff like that. So I'm going to obviously do a little bit of a history lesson as well, in terms of there are different types of killers, serial killers, spree killers, mass murders. So we're going to kind of, because that's how also I learned in school. You didn't just focus on one or the other. You kind of had to learn, here's the difference between this, this, and this. And we'll kind of do that, and then we'll kind of jump into kind of maybe more of those more quote unquote popular serial killers, and we can kind of go from there. I think most of the serial killers that I touch on are from the 70s, which is a time all of its own when it comes to serial killers.
Yeah.
So 70s was scary. I don't know how anyone survived. No, I mean, Mikel, you have no clue. California alone had many that I don't get it.
Well, I did watch some, you know, I don't know if you guys know the series called Snowfall, you know, like
that's
based on the true story. Yeah,
oh, okay.
It's based on the true story. So, yeah. So, yeah, I can imagine that, you know, California has like, you know, a number of murders. So,
well, they do, but the 70s in general was so many between, like, I would say between like the 70s into the 80s, even there was to have serial killers in one place like that, and that to that extreme is crazy. I mean, you had the try to remember all of them right now. You had the Golden State Killer, you had what was the ones that they were calling them, but there was two of them, not just
the Zodiac
one.
Killer.
The Zodiac Killer was another one, but he was kind of in the 60s into the 70s, and then he kind of went away. But no, it was the one that was the cousins, and they both were doing it, but they thought it was only one at first. And the person who solved that too was the same guy who solved Ramirez. But anyways, can't remember his name, but there's so many. It's nuts. And I happen to do most of them in the 70s. But I do have a Canadian one too. So there's that too. So, just as a little history.
Okay.
The definition of a serial killer is a person who commits a series of murders, often with no apparent motive, and typically following a characteristic, predictable behavior pattern. So that's a serial killer. That's a term that was coined by the FBI, the behavioral unit. I do have that guy's name, but again, if you've watched like Mindhunter, you already know that story, behind that story. So there are also like four different types of serial killers, which is the visionary, the mission oriented, the power control oriented. There's so many other ones too. Like, and you kind of also get like those ones that have that God complex as well. Well, they're also narcissists. So those God complex ones, like Ted Bundy, I would say kind of had not so much the God complex, but more of that narcissist attitude towards him. Figured he can do anything and he can, you know, do be his own lawyer, which, again, if you know the story of Ted Bundy, then you know all of that. But there's so many different types. So yeah, so a serial killer is usually defined by someone who has killed three or more people. So if you've killed less, then you're not a serial killer, you're just still a monster, but you're not a serial killer. And it usually is done in separate incidents with a cooling off period between each murder. So that cooling off period could be different for each person. You know, you could have, you know, like a BTK who took, they don't know if necessarily he did anything in between, but he took a long, long cooling period until he decided, I think I might do this again. And then he was caught. I don't believe I'm talking about him. I don't think I am. No, I might be. I can't remember now. But he took a long cooling off period, probably because he was a father. He had kids. I guess maybe he decided he was going to focus on them. And eventually he was caught, not because he killed somebody, but because he was an idiot. So there's that.
Would you say Jeffrey Dahmer is a serial killer or no?
100%. Yeah, no, Jeffrey Dahmer is a serial killer. He killed 17, I believe, people. So he would be considered a serial killer. So yeah. Serial killers have been reported throughout history. I'm going to kind of name some of those people. The first documented serial killer was a woman. I don't know if I should hate that or like that, but I'm going to say that's kind of interesting. Because women technically, based on statistics, it's usually men that are known to be serial killers. It's very rare.
It's kind of the right time this month, too.
Oh, God. The month that we're recording this in, yeah. Geez.
Woman history.
But I think not to interrupt, but I think that that's why there's even more obsession when there is a female serial killer, is because it is more rare, and I don't know. There's a fascination with serial killers anyway, but more so when it's female ones.
When they're and then you have like an Eileen Wuornos too, who. It was so weird with her because, like, here she is killing men who are taking advantage of her. And although not great, she kind of had this support behind her as well, which is a little different. I mean, she's no longer on this earth. She died by lethal injection, but she had this kind of this weird support behind her, because this is something that all women deal with, if men who take advantage of them, and she was kind of the one that had the guts to say, no, you're not going to do this, and I'm going to kill you. And that's extreme, mind you, but as a woman, I also understand her, which is so weird.
I kind of get surprised when, you know, when women become a serial killer. So, like, it's a surprise to me that, you know.
I mean, it happens. It definitely does.
Yeah.
I mean, their method of killing will make 9 times out of 10 is a little different. Eileen Wuornos was also special because she used a gun to kill her first victims. But that's also abnormal as well. Usually, women who become serial killers usually use poisons because it's cleaner, right?
That's their number one.
They might use, like, you know, even what you call it, I can't remember, but yeah, they use poisons because it's cleaner. And especially back in the day, like a long, long time ago, some of the things couldn't even be traced. Like, you couldn't find certain poisons in your system because it couldn't be traced. So it was just so much easier as well. Like, even, like, I know, like, certain, this is not a serial killer, but the story of I shouldn't know the name because I hear it all the time, but the axe murders in Massachusetts. Sorry, guys, I forget her name right now.
I don't remember her name.
It's one of the more famous ones, but she was accused of killing her father and her stepmom. And she was acquitted because they didn't have enough evidence. Because how can a woman do that, right?
Where was this at, or do you know?
It was Massachusetts. It was Massachusetts, but I can't remember where Massachusetts it was. And anyone who listens to Morbid is screaming right now because they talk about it all the time. Because they are from Massachusetts, but I cannot remember her name. But yeah, like, even if she did do it, taking an axe and axing your father and your stepmom, like, that's something that you don't see a lot of. But anyway. So this woman's name, who was the first documented serial killer, her name was LaCosta, and she was from Rome, and she was actually hired to kill several members of the imperial family. She was a hit woman. Kind of interesting. Serial killers were also documented in medieval times in England, Germany, Hungary, and Italy, which obviously Rome I just mentioned, but the number and recordings of serial killers rose in the 19th century due to better record keeping. So some historical ones I think a lot of us will know. Jack the Ripper. And if you don't know who Jack the Ripper is, in 1888, he killed and mutilated at least 5 women in the city of London. His crimes were vicious and deeply disturbing. Jack the Ripper was never found or convicted and thus got away with his crimes. And there's been a lot of theories as to who Jack the Ripper is, you know, from people who actually lived in London to H.H. Holmes, for example. There's been so many different people that have been accused of being Jack the Ripper, but ultimately we don't know who he was. And he did this in a short span of time. I think he started in August, and by October he was done, never heard of again. We have the Killer Clown. If you don't know who the Killer Clown is either.
I don't know that one.
Oh really?
I don't know it,
well, I know, Mikel, you might not. So John Wayne Gacy, does that ring a bell?
That sounds more familiar than the Killer Clown.
They referred to him as the Killer Clown because he would actually dress up as a clown. But he only did that, I think, for like a birthday party. So I'm not sure why the Killer Clown thing stuck, but it did. But John Wayne Gacy was a serial killer and a rapist who killed over 33. They say men on here, but honestly, I want to say boys. He killed young boys, teenagers, throughout the 1970s. He's also called the Killer Clown because he would dress up like a clown for children's birthdays. He was charged multiple times with sexual assaults of young men. When he was finally convicted of the murder of Robert Peast, which is like, that's a crazy one. If you don't know the story of John Wayne Gacy, this was basically like he abducted this, not quote unquote abducted this kid in plain sight. He walked into a store where he was working, said, "I have a job for you." And that's how he would usually get people into his home. He would say, "I have a job for you." And he would hire young men or boys. And he's like, "Yeah, my mom's coming to pick me up, but sure, I'll come talk to you." And he got in his car, never seen again until they found his body. And the weird thing is that there were other people in that store and they clocked him. They clocked John Wayne Gacy in there, said he was the last person who saw him alive. And it was kind of, he probably never would have gotten caught otherwise, because he kind of went for people who were more vagrant and he was not. So it was kind of his undoing. He abducted him and murdered him in 1978. The truth about his previous killings came out at that time. The bodies of the boys and men he murdered were found buried in his crawl space. So that's how he was caught. He's dead as well. So there's that too.
You know how he died, or did he just like, you know, rotten?
I'm trying to remember. I think at the time they still, and this was in Illinois, I think they still had the death penalty in Illinois at the time. So I think he died from lethal injection. And the funny thing too is because you mentioned Jeffrey Dahmer, there was the connection between Gacy and Dahmer in the sense of they suspect that Jeffrey Dahmer kind of quote unquote idolized Gacy. I think when he was eventually killed by lethal injection, Gacy, I think it was not long after that Dahmer was captured, I believe. I might be wrong with the timeline, but I think that's roughly,
I think it was in that documentary that he was inspired.
They showed
him.
They showed him. Yeah, they did. And I don't want to say documentary. It was a series, but yes.
Oh, a series.
Did.
My bad.
Yeah, they did. Yeah, they did mention him in that for sure. So there are many different traits of a serial killer. It doesn't necessarily mean that a serial killer will have all of these traits, or if you have these traits, you're a serial killer. It's just things that they have gathered throughout time to kind of say, these are what a lot of them have in common. So they could have lack of empathy, lack of remorse, so kind of the ones that we kind of all know, impulsivity, grandiosity, so that's where the narcissism kind of comes in. Well, I said narcissism, but I already said that. Superficial charm. So, like, Bundy had a very superficial charm. Manipulation, a lot of them do. And an addictive personality, because they have to have more of that, right? There's, that is what it was so, I think, I hate to give BTK anything, but that was one of the things that was interesting about him, because he had clearly this addictive personality to what he was doing, and then took that long cooling off period. That's what he's why he's one of the more interesting cases with serial killers.
Right.
So there's also that like question of whether or not a serial killer is made or is born this way. And I mean, I feel like I've gone back and forth with this from when I kind of learned this in school till even now. I feel like, yes, there has to be something, some sort of gene in you, which they've kind of established that with Paul Bernardo. But he kind of has this gene that is kind of made him maybe do what he does. But I also think it is also how you are brought up, the environment that you're brought up in.
It's that nature or nurture.
Versus nurture.
It could be around. You could be around like friends. You could be around your parents. You could
your parent and how you're raised. I do think friends can influence, but I think a lot of times the ones that I've heard, it's usually how they're raised and in the environment they're raised in. There are serial killers who have had perfect childhoods and still do what they do. But 9 times out of 10, it's not. Like Paul Bernardo did not have a great childhood. And also that once he found out his father wasn't his father, he went off the deep end. Ted Bundy, he wanted to tell the world, I had a great childhood. And he did to a point. But when he also found out that his father wasn't his father, it became an issue for him.
But that's kind of similar to what, so I cover court every week for my local papers, and you'll hear defense lawyers come up with something and they'll say, oh, he was drunk at the time, doesn't remember anything. I'm offering this not as an explanation, but as a, you know, as background or whatever, not as an excuse, but as an explanation is what they say. And that's, you know, you've seen umpteen episodes on Law and Order or other TV dramas where they have something like, oh, it's how he was brought up, or it's a gene or something like that. And they try to turn that into an excuse of like, oh, well, he can't possibly be considered guilty because he had XYZ in his background or that kind of thing. And it's kind of a weird, you know, splitting hairs sometimes as to whether you are genuinely excusing what they did. Is there an excuse for what somebody did that was a violent crime or multiple violent crimes? Generally not.
No, there is no excuse.
Yeah, do you know what I mean? But there's that
100%.
It's a legal. There's the legal version, and then I think we find it in listeners of or viewers of true crime is we then try to come up with an explanation because we're desperate for an explanation as
to why this person did this. Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And sometimes, like, yeah, like kind of hearing the whole, the excuse, especially the he was drunk excuse. Well, if in your drunken state, you are capable of doing something like this, it was always in you.
Yeah.
Because there are many people that I know who have been drunk and don't go and kill somebody. And there is no excuse. I honestly have come to a point with true crime where it's like, there are monsters in the world who are capable of doing things to people for no reason. And that's all there is to it. There is no other explanation of that. There's just monsters in this world. And unfortunately, you know, these monsters encounter people who, because of them, lose their life. Because, I mean, they kind of look like, we're going to be doing an episode of this later on, but even just looking at like the Manson family and them going in there to more than one home, but going into people's homes and killing them just for their own purposes, just for their own reasons. I'm sorry, but I can't find a reason for these people to kill Sharon Tate, who's begging not for her life, but for her child's life, because she was pregnant at the time. And this person laughing in her face and still killing her. I'm sorry, I can't find an explanation to that. And then you're just disgusting and you're a monster.
I can't either. Like, that's ridiculous.
Yeah. The ones that I encounter, I don't encounter many murderers, thankfully.
Good.
But my local area has one of the worst statistics for domestic abuse. So that's the case. That's the type of case that I hear over and over and over again. And that's it's not serial killing, but it is serial offending. And it's the same stuff over and over again. And they are always searching for excuses or explanations. And, you know, particularly with some of the worst ones, it would not have taken much for it to cross the line from an assault to murder.
Of course.
The capacity is there.
Yeah. I mean, even just, again, I'm going to bring Love is Blind in because it's still in there, you know. But there was one of the people who was on the show, girlfriend, came to on TikTok and said, this was my experience with this person. And I'm not saying that he is this way now, but this was my experience with him. And there was a lot of this possession telling her what to do. And so ultimately, she's in the home with him and he's pointing a gun in her face. And God only knows what could have happened in that situation. What if he did pull the trigger? Luckily, she got out and called the cops. And once the cops came in, they're like, is he like a drug dealer? Like, is something like this? There are so many guns in this house. And she was absolutely unaware of this fact. And that just kind of, again, this kind of goes to show, like, what are the chances that he didn't do that again with somebody else? He's currently with somebody else who's on the show. And they have apparently been on and off in a year. All I can think of after watching his ex-girlfriend talk about this and watching him on the reunion is, you're a violent person. There's no way. Like, I never been in a relationship where a man that I'm with is pulling a gun on me. Like, it's just, there's certain people who have that in them. And if you do, there are no excuses. There are no excuses for putting your hands on a woman. Yeah. If you have some anger in you that needs to come out, then take it to the gym. Take it to boxing or whatever. Do what you need to do to release that energy. Don't be putting it on women or whatever. Like, that's just there is no excuse for that behavior.
Well, going back to the parent thing, a lot of them who do domestic violence basically see it through their parents' house.
Exactly.
In their household.
And they think it's okay.
So, like, and they think it's like it's okay to, you know, do it upon other women or, you know, other men.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because well. Women so, do too. Women.
Yeah.
So it's, and it's not the cycle has to end.
I saw a case just last week that was sheriff, the equivalent of a judge, was slamming the guy for claiming, oh, the house was a mess and that was her fault. And that was his explanation as to why he had terrified her and everything.
It's ridiculous. Yeah, like, right. You do something then if you have an issue with how the house looks.
Yeah.
I have a question. And this has been in a lot of like articles and, you know, a lot of news TV as well. Do you guys think that, you know, violent television and violent video games have anything to do with people becoming murderers or having an influence to murderers?
No. No.
I mean, if that was actually true, there would be so many more murders and violent crime than there is. Because how many millions of people play, you know,
video games
or watch TV shows or things like that? No.
I mean, I think honestly, like, the reason that this has become a thing is it's just a crutch for people to kind of use. Look at the Satanic Panic. The whole thing around Satanic Panic, which, spoiler alert, we might talk about this in a future episode, but Satanic Panic is something that people use because, oh my gosh, he listens to rock music. It's the devil music. So that's why we made him do it. It's so ridiculous.
It's saying, go ahead, Tristan.
No, sorry. I mean, it's just a recurring, this has been going on for decades of coming up with an excuse. It's not just violent video games or TV, which is always fitted into a right wing or far right. Oh, let's clamp down on things. But 100%. But I mean, that is also the excuse for targeting the LGBTQ community, both in, you know, from the 80s right up till, you know, the new trans panic. At the moment, where they just argue, oh well, it's, if we don't see them in the media, then this word contagion, that if you don't see it in the media, if you don't interact with it, then it won't exist or something.
That's what they're doing to drag queens right now, accusing, you know, drag queens of being these monsters when they're not. Like, even look at Florida right now. You can't say gay, apparently. That's illegal. And it's just like, are you kidding me? Like, again, you have people, especially in the States, who hold on to things and are like, this is bad. Like, it's going to influence our children. And it's like, no. First of all, if someone identifies as queer in the end of the day, that's something that's been in them from birth.
Yeah.
Right? And this whole thing of, because again, that's an argument people have of whether or not being gay is a choice. It's not. Mm-hmm. Like, it's so, that I didn't choose to be a straight woman. I just am. So
it's a deflection.
Of course. Like, why is it okay for a heterosexual person to just be this way? But someone who is queer, it's like, no, they chose that. It's so dumb.
I agree. Yeah,
and I think whenever somebody brings up an argument of that, my default is to ask, what are they deflecting from? What are you trying to distract us from by putting the attention there? And usually in the case of Republicans in the U.S. or right-wing people, it's usually because we don't want to address guns. So we just want as many guns as possible. So let's blame something else. Stupid, but I that in itself also doesn't, you know.
The gun.
No, sorry. I mean, guns. I was just thinking, it made me think of the Dunblane massacre in Scotland years ago. The UK does not have many firearms at all. It is not anywhere near, you know,
what
police
it is
don't
state.
Police don't carry them.
Oh, really?
Yeah, with the exception of special units. Oh, wow. And special incidents where there might be a weapon that would require to respond with armed officers. Officers are not armed with guns.
That's the same thing in England, actually. I feel like I did hear that. Is that the same thing in England?
It's a UK thing.
Right, okay.
And part of that part of that increased as a response to Dunblane. Dunblane was effective in clamping down on the limited gun availability that there was. But that certainly wasn't influenced by, you know, the media or anything like that. There was nowhere to look in terms of blame, at least in terms of the legislation, other than guns.
Yeah.
And availability. Mm. So, I think whenever these things come up, I just, you know, what are they deflecting from? And certainly the Republicans in the US love to deflect from anything that they can't possibly tackle.
Yeah.
I mean, look at the 100%. Response to, it was one of them, the school mass shootings. I think it was the one in Florida. And
Parkland.
Yes. And Trump's response to that was, well, we should just have guns in the school. Teachers should just have guns in the school, and then that way they can combat a school shooter. So the answer to guns is guns. That sounds about right.
Which didn't even work in Texas. Was that last year, the year before? The Uvalde shooting.
Yeah.
I mean, they were armed in the corridors for 90 minutes.
Texas. Yeah. Texas have guns. And exactly. It didn't do anything. It just baffles me. And the funny thing is, too, like, we're all Canadians here. We're all Canadian. Mm-hmm. But the thing, too, is, like, me and my mom watching, like, Fear Thy Neighbor, for example. And we concluded after watching, I don't know, 20 episodes of Fear Thy Neighbor, that do you notice that none of these are happening in Canada or anywhere else where you don't have the right to bear arms? It's happening in the States with the people who have the right to bear arms, and then it creates this level of fear, right? Like the one I just finished watching yesterday, I can't remember where it was, where they were. I feel like it was Texas too. Yeah, it was Texas. This woman asleep in her bed with her kids had her son shoot her. The neighbor had her son go to this woman's window and shoot her in the head in front of her kids. And I won't go into the reason, but it was, they're quote unquote fighting over a man. Long story, but if you want to find, I'm sure you can find it. And this is what luckily she survived, because it was a deep flesh wound, but nonetheless, it was a flesh wound. There was no entry. So she survived. But it's like, okay, so the way to solve an issue is for you to tell your son, who just came back from army training, to shoot this woman in the head in front of her kids. Makes sense. Again, I don't get it. I'm Canadian.
But it's easy for us as Canadians to act like, oh well, we are morally superior, or we're so much better. And unfortunately, when Canada does not make the UK news, and when it does, wow, they go all out. So the serial killer in Nova Scotia, Picton years ago.
Picton.
You know, those ones go, when Canadians really go all out, we have some awful crimes. And I was just thinking, there are serial killers where it's not a single killer, But if you think of like the Highway of Tears, that's not a single killer, but that's it. That is a serial offense or a serial target, or do you know what I mean? So there's almost a systemic. It's not a single killer, but it's a systemic killing of a particular community. You know, so yeah, and unfortunately, we do have our capacities for.
Oh, we're not perfect.
Awful. Yeah.
We have guns. Yeah. We are not perfect. And I mean, I wish I kind of actually talked. I wish I had taken notes to talk about Picton. I'm actually going to talk about Bernardo, but Picton's crimes were disgusting. And again, was his crimes went completely under the radar because this was a person who was a part of the community and was seen as a quote-unquote good guy, and his victim choice were all Native Canadians for the most part, and sex workers. So double whammy in this country, apparently. Like, you know, there's no respect for the Indigenous people, and he got away with it for so long. And the part that's also really disgusting about him is, if your beef supply, or sorry, pork supply, it was pigs he had, right? If your pork supply, your meat between the 90s, somewhere in the 90s there, maybe early aughts, could have potentially come from his farm. And let's just say it may not have been pork. So
that's, I did a feature back in early in my career, so 2003, on, it was after Picton had been arrested, and I did a feature looking at violence against sex workers in Canada, and I looked at across the country, and it was far more common, and I'm sure it still is, than just one serial killer. And I remember calling an organization in Toronto and asking, saying who I was and what I was doing, and they said, oh, I'm glad you called, we might have a serial killer on the loose and nobody's really reporting on it. And
I actually find in comparison to the States, I feel like I don't know enough about the serial killers that are here in this country, in Canada. And it's there's no way that we don't have more than what we have, or the more quote unquote again popular ones that we all know. There has to be more.
But I don't think it necessarily needs to be, like I said with the Highway of Tears, it doesn't necessarily need to be one. It might not be one person, but there might be so much similarity in terms of the people targeted or the location that it's a systemic killer, and it's rather than one person getting away with it, it's multiple ones. Multiple. And because it maybe doesn't tick that one box to make it a serial killer, then that's, you know, they take the focus off of it as much, or it's a bit harder to find a resolution to it, or as with was the case for so long with Picton, they didn't care because of who the victims were.
Do you guys think it's like a corruption issue with, like, you know, the police and, you know, the news?
I think sometimes with corruption, or sometimes with police, but more to do with an attitude, at least certainly years ago, to who the victims were.
And it still is that way now.
Yeah.
It still is that way now, yeah.
Yeah, in Vancouver, in terms of Picton, women were going missing from the downtown east side. The downtown east side, Hastings and Maine, is a 15-minute walk from where the province and the Vancouver Sun was based. So it is not that far. Canada's poorest postcode was, you could see it from the building. So in that case, I've always attributed it to laziness and an attitude that the women were disposable, that the victims were disposable.
Yeah, and you have that all over the world. It's not just here in Canada, it's not just in the States. It happens in the UK. There was, and I can't remember his name right now, but there was a serial killer in, I believe it was England, who was picking up sex workers and, you know, was killing them, and he was getting away with it for quite some time until I think cops came upon him. Like, they didn't know there's something going on, these cases are linked, but they just weren't able to catch him until they finally came upon him, and they found him with the murder weapon that he'd used in other cases as well. So, and I can't remember what the murder weapon, I feel like it was like a hammer or something, and I can't remember, but it happens everywhere. And this was in the 80s, like I said, so this was happening, it's happening then, it's happening now. And that is why sex work has this danger attached to it, because you just never know who you're going to come upon and how that person is going to treat you. Like, even look at the Long Island killer who they just recently caught, but his cases were going on from before that. You had the, I think it's the Gringo Beach Five, and there was another person as well who was a sex worker, but most, I think, believe all of those victims were sex workers, and he got away with it for a long time. They just arrested him like late last year, and I didn't think they were going to solve the case personally, but there is a movie about that too on Lifetime. I can't remember what the movie's called, but there is a movie on it, and like, if you rather do that, or you can listen to podcasts about it too. Like, it's an interesting story because there is so much, that story has corruption the within the police department. There's corruption in there, and why this probably is the reason why it didn't get solved faster than it did.
I think the word corruption gets thrown around a lot, and people always say to me about local planning issues, oh, it's
corrupt.
Politicians getting brown envelopes full of cash. Okay, well, if that's the case, then show me the proof. And it doesn't exist. But I think it's an easy deflection. You know, if you listen to, for example, season one of The Village, the Justin Ling podcast about the gay murders in Toronto years ago. And you know, that there is certainly the police ignoring the victims because of who they were, but I'm not sure if that rises to the level of corruption. Do you know what I mean?
No, I don't consider that corruption. But more so, like, I'm assuming we're talking about MacArthur, right?
Yeah. I'm just going to remember the name of it.
Yeah. I think with his victims, it wasn't so much that the men were gay, because a lot of them hadn't come out to even family.
Yeah.
Some of them were actually married to women, so it wasn't so much about that, but it was about the fact that these men that he was choosing were, some of them at least anyways, didn't have their immigration status was non-existent. Some of them had overstayed visas, they weren't permanent residents. It was more about that, and they figured that, oh well, he's not a citizen or permanent resident of Canada, so he probably just ran away. But why? Because one minute he's living his life with his family, and the next minute he's gone. No one just disappears. And that's the thing that you hear a lot, especially with this watching, like, Disappeared. The running theme is, oh, they just maybe ran away, or they don't want to be found, or whatever. There was, out of the 10 seasons that I watched of Disappeared, only one case did the person actually run away on purpose and did not want to be found. And once the story came out, she contacted police saying, I'm fine, I don't want to talk to my family, but I'm okay. One case. All the others, they can't be found. Or if they are ever found, it's their bodies being found. No one just chooses to disappear. That's the thing. MacArthur got away with his crimes for that reason, because people thought, oh, they probably just ran away, and was able to continue on with his killings because of it. And I mean, there's so much more we can talk about with MacArthur. I think there was a lot of self-hatred and stuff like that, because I still to this day just don't understand how the Jeffrey Dahmers and Art MacArthur, it's just, you're targeting other gay men. But no, you know what? I'm actually not going to say that. MacArthur was different, because he had come out, if I'm correct. Because he was married to a woman initially, and then he's like, oh, well, you know, I think this is who I am, which is fine. Mm. Whatever, you're going through a journey of figuring yourself out, and if you identify as gay, that's fine. I just... Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean then he should have been killing people. Like, I think just in general, generally speaking, if you have some sort of self-hatred, it doesn't matter what the reason is, you shouldn't be putting that on other people. So
self-hatred doesn't necessarily mean that. I mean, I had the misfortune many years ago to have gone on a few dates with somebody who, years after I met him, ended up killing somebody.
Oh my god.
And I knew at the time that I met him that he had self-hatred. And that manifested in a very different way, obviously, than when he met up with this other person. But I don't think that, you know, plenty of people in the LGBT community, not necessarily self-hatred, but it takes a while to be comfortable with ourselves, and that kind of thing. That doesn't necessarily mean you're going to kill somebody.
Exactly.
In the same way as, you know, watching a video game about murder isn't going to, or, you know, shooting up zombies isn't going to lead to something. You know, it's there is such a complicated set of factors, and maybe that's, again, part of that fascination with serial killers or killers generally, is that we're trying to figure out what combination of things, what one thing or what five things turned a normal person who could be my neighbor into, or somebody I went on a date with, into a killer.
Mm-hmm. And that's the thing. That's and kind of following with that with Dahmer. Yes, he had self-hatred and mm-hmm. he didn't, and that a lot came from, I think, his religious, like, he had a very religious grandmother. Obviously that probably trickled over to his father, and probably just didn't feel comfortable coming out. Again, this was, you know, 70s, 80s, 90s. So it was just a different time as well. But I think a lot with Dahmer wasn't just because of his self-hatred, but also this, I guess, fear of rejection and wanting to not have someone leave him. But realistically, even if someone's not rejecting you, eventually they do have to leave, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think, like, with him, his psychopathy just goes so much more deeper than this self-hatred towards himself, or this uncomfortability in his sexuality. I think it also has had to do with something else. So yes, that can be a factor, but there's usually, I think, something else along with it. If talking about, you know, the LGBTQ community targeting their own. So let's get back to this too. We definitely got off on a tangent.
It's all good.
Mm. So the term serial murder, as I mentioned before, was popularized in the 1970s. That's when the BAU kind of started, by Robert Ressler, who was, again, like I said, a part of the BAU, behavioral unit. So as mentioned before, like I said, there's different type of murders that I definitely learned in school, because we had to do criminal law when I was doing my clerking course. And the one thing we learned is that there are serial killers, and there's also mass murders. So the definition of a mass murder is a violent crime of killing a number of people, typically simultaneously or over a relatively short period of time and in proximity. Mass murder typically occurs in a single location where one or more persons kill several others. So that would be like a school shooting, so like Columbine or Parkland, like we mentioned, that would be considered a mass murder. There are definitely other types of mass murders that happen that are not just happening in schools, but that is
the one in
The one in the movie theater would be another one, would be another example. That was them going to see Batman, I believe.
Batman, yeah.
Yeah. That's another one. So usually also mass murderers tend to kill people familiar to them. It could be neighbors, coworkers, on top of also strangers. So the one that kind of comes to mind for me is Sandy Hook is one that comes to mind for me, which, I mean, I will never forget when I heard about Sandy Hook. Actually, Mikkel, I was with you when that came up on the news, and I'll never forget. Like, that's an example of them kind of going and killing other people before they go and they commit this mass murder, which is anyway. Familicide, which is another definition of a mass murder. So family annihilator is the other term for that. And it's one of actually the most common forms of mass murder, which is so scary to me, but yeah, that's another one. So in many cases, mass murderers also die during the event. Very rarely do they survive because they usually kill themselves. I think the Parkland shooter was the one that was most recent where he lived after that, which is I remember thinking, oh my god, he's alive. Like, I did not think, like, I thought for sure he would have, because every other one does before him and even since him. So it was interesting that they actually were able to not actually either they do self-infliction or they'll have the police basically do it. So that was interesting. They typically either take their own lives, as I said, or killed by law enforcement. So the 2000 saw several high profile mass murders in the United States. On June 12th, 2016, 29-year-old Omar Mateen walked into the Pulse Dance Club in Orlando, Florida, which was popular for the local LGBTQ+ community, and began shooting into the crowd from the entrance. I think that also needs to be categorized as a hate crime as well. But yeah, that's an event I think, like, honestly, no one should ever forget. Because you forget and you don't learn. So that was a horrible one. Mateen was killed after a lengthy standoff with police. The incident resulted in 49 people dead and more than 50 people wounded, making it the deadliest mass shooting in U.S. history up to that time. More than a year later, October 1st, 2017, 64-year-old Stephen Paddock targeted a crowd of concertgoers on the Las Vegas Strip from a hotel room, possessing an arsenal of 23 guns, 12 of which had been upgraded with bump stocks to make them fire faster. Paddock shot more than 1,100 rounds in just 10 minutes. By the end of his rampage, 58 people had been killed and hundreds wounded. When police finally breached Paddock's room, they found him dead from a self-inflicted gunshot wound. I remember Dr. Phil actually talking about that after it happened, and I think it was his ex-girlfriend or his girl. I don't know if they were still together. And there was another person that they had interviewed too, who were completely shocked by this. They did not expect him to do anything like this, and also couldn't understand why he did it. And we'll never know why he did it, because obviously he killed himself. But I do find that interesting when people say, I don't know why this person did this, but there had to have been something. No one just decides one day, you know what, I think I'm going to shoot people in Las Vegas. Like, no one comes up with that. This was, and the account, the guns he had and the types that he had, this was planned. There's just no way that you missed the mark on this.
I feel like a lot of mass murders are basically influenced from the others as well. So, like,
I can understand that.
Yeah, so, like, yeah. And there's a one in Charleston too, Charleston church shooting. You remember that one?
Yep.
No, actually, I don't. Like Charleston, North Carolina? Or Charleston is in North Carolina or South Carolina?
Yeah, South Carolina.
South Carolina, okay.
Yeah. It was basically an anti-black mass shooting. So,
person killed,
let me just, 9 people. And then it was like basically one injured. So, this happened in 2015.
Okay.
It was crazy.
Yeah, I feel like there was a lot of mass murders happening in pretty close proximity to each other. Like, even these ones I just mentioned was 2016 and 2017. I feel like even before that, because then there was Sandy Hook, and I feel that there was another one after that too. And I feel like there was an issue going on, definitely, with the amount of mass murders that were happening. I don't know if you necessarily consider, I consider this at least a mass attack, if not a murder. But the bombing of the Boston Marathon bombing,
sure.
That was also not long before all of this too. And, I don't understand, that's the wrong word to use, but I know why they did what they did. But again, it's just like,
was there a reason why they did it? I don't remember.
I actually highly recommend, if you haven't watched, there is a documentary on Netflix that goes a lot more in depth with this and with the Boston Marathon bombing. But it was all because they felt like them being Muslim, with the hate that was going on because of the Islamic hatred, Islamophobia that was going on, they felt personally targeted because of that. I think also there was a lot more going on behind the scenes with the older brother that was also influencing the younger brother to do what they ended up doing. So I think in many ways it was a terrorist attack in a sense. So I think it had a lot to do with that. Unfortunately, this was a time, and we're still in it, where there is this Islamophobia. And again, Republicans do not help with that. So I think that was the main reason. And although I understand that there's not a lot of respect towards Muslim people, that does not give you the right to go and target people who are not your enemy.
Yeah.
So
I think with that one, and also other, it's really easy to, hindsight is 2020, as they say. It's really easy for us to say afterwards, I saw the signs, or I didn't see the signs.
Yeah.
But actually, none of us sort of go around looking at people in the street and thinking, oh yeah, that guy looks like he might be a killer someday. Do you know what I mean? Like,
that's true.
It's really easy. It's really easy for us to say it afterwards, and very difficult to see it in the moment. And no matter how obsessed people are with true crime or serial killers or things like that, I think the vast majority of people would still miss
the mark,
a clue, or a sign before something happened.
I mean, at least like when they had like friends who were interviewing, who knew the younger brother of the Boston Marathon bombing, they were, and I believe them, were completely shocked by all of this, because he didn't seem to be this extremist in the same way that his brother was. And maybe the signs weren't there with the younger one, but the older one, at the very least, if not the knowledge of, oh yeah, they might bomb the marathon or something, or bomb another place, it was at the mirror that the minimum is he was an extremist. And I feel like if not seen, it was ignored, especially by their parents. It was ignored. And then there's also potentially the wife was somewhat involved. Like, hey, yeah, the older one was married. Was she involved in all of this too? Like, they don't know, and they can't. There are no charges coming down on her because they don't know. But I think at the very least, he was an extremist, and that was missed. That's not necessarily saying he would have done what he did, but at the very least, it did that. And it wasn't just the bombing that happened. There's a lot more to this story than just the bombing. It did not end with the bombing. So there is that too. So that's why I highly recommend, like, if you haven't seen it and you want to know more about the Boston Marathon bombing, I wish I can't remember the name of it on Netflix, but I'm sure if you just type in Boston Marathon bombing, it'll probably pop up. And it is a really well done documentary. And so, yeah, I would definitely take a watch and learn a lot more of what happened, because there were things I didn't know. I didn't know that it went beyond the bombing.
It's called The American Manhunt, the Boston Marathon Bombing.
Yeah, that is it. So the final type of killer that we learn about is something called a spree killer. Now, there's a lot of, this can be a little more confusing because there is similarity between spree and mass. But the difference between...
Yeah, I was thinking the same thing.
Yeah, there are similarities, but it's still a little different. So a spree killer is someone who commits a criminal act that involves two or more murders in a short time. So that's... someone who goes from one location and goes to another location and is killing multiple people. So there are different opinions about what durations of time a killing spree may take place in, but it has to be in a short amount of time. So one of those serial killers, now that we're going to kind of jump into that conversation, and as mentioned, I'm going to be talking about maybe a couple of serial killers from the 70s. Ted Bundy is one of them. And he was born on November 24th, 1946, in Burlington, Vermont. And he died on January 24th in 1989 in Stark, Florida, by lethal injection. He was an American serial killer and rapist, and one of the most notorious criminals of the late 20th century. I've mentioned before, as I kind of said, like Bundy says, he didn't have a great childhood. He did have a great childhood, but he actually had a difficult childhood. He had a strained relationship with his stepfather, and his shyness also made him a frequent target of bullying. Later, however, his intelligence and his social skills enabled him to enjoy a successful college career, and he developed a series of apparently normal emotional relationships with women. One of those women have actually come out to tell her story. I think they did a 2020 interview. So he did have a relationship, and she had a daughter. So, you know, he definitely had a normal life. He was very smart. But despite this apparent stability that he had, he's actually assaulted and killed several young women in Washington, Oregon, Colorado, Utah, and Florida between 1974 and 1978. Although he would ultimately confess to 28 of the murders, some estimated that he was responsible for hundreds of deaths. Following a well-publicized trial, he was sentenced to death in 1979 for the murder of two college students. That was in Florida, because he was charged in, was it Colorado before? And he was indicted, or not indicted, he was seen found guilty in Colorado. But then he, because he had done, so, okay, let's do the backstory, because I don't think it's mentioned here. He was charged in Colorado. He escaped prison because he acted as his own attorney. So because of this, he was allowed to go into the library, obviously with supervision. But the supervision wasn't that good because he was able to escape out of the window that was on the second story of this courthouse. And he escaped, successfully escaped. And he fled to Florida, where he would kill these two college students. And he was also convicted of killing a 12-year-old, raping and killing a 12-year-old girl as well. And that was also in Florida. And I believe that's the one that caused him to be even charged with capital murder, honestly, because that's sick, obviously. Bundy was then executed in Florida's electric... Oh, that's right, as a lethal injection, it was electric chair in 1989. Despite the appalling nature of his crimes, Bundy became something of a celebrity, particularly following his escape from custody, as mentioned, in Colorado in 1977. During his trial, his charm and intelligence drew significant public attention. His case inspired a series of popular novels and films devoted to serial murder. It also galvanized feminist criminologists who contended that the popular media had transformed Bundy into a romantic figure. And they did. Because the thing that you hear so much about Bundy is, oh, he was so hot, he's so good looking, he's this, he's that, he's so charming. He killed women, y'all. So all of you who are talking about, oh, he's so hot and all of this or whatever, he would have killed you in a heartbeat. Especially if you, because he definitely had a type that he went after. He would have killed you. And the thing too is the darkness in him definitely showed when he was doing the trial in, I believe it was Florida. And he lost it on one of the people who were on the stand. I can't remember if it was a victim. And that's the other thing too. He had victims who survived his attacks, who had to ultimately face him because he was his own attorney. And there is a scene, if you can search for it, I found it on YouTube, and it's not easy to find, but you can find this particular scene of him, actual Ted Bundy, in this rage-induced state and how dark his eyes got. It's scary. So I don't understand how people are like, oh my god, he's so cute. Like, I don't get it. He's not.
Is there a reason why? Is there a reason why women like criminals? Like
danger.
Like,
so it's the danger male aspect.
Okay.
It's the danger aspect. Guy? Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Even I feel like it's even far beyond that guy. It's the danger. It's that adrenaline rush. That's what. And the thing is, when he was in prison, I don't know if he got married to her, but he had a girlfriend. He had a girlfriend. I think they got married, actually. And he had a child with her. He was in prison. And this woman believed his innocence until she eventually came to her senses. And it's like, oh no, you're gross. And she never saw him again. The child never saw him again. So, like, I don't... understand. I don't get it. Even like with Richard Ramirez, same thing. This guy was going into people's homes and killing them, was kidnapping children and raping them. And we all want to be out here being like, oh, but he's so dreamy. No, no, he's not. The minute the man opens his mouth, you should be terrified because he had really bad oral hygiene. And that's the one thing that all of his victims who survived him remembered about him, how bad he smelled. So I don't understand. Like, to this day, I will never understand women who are like, oh, but that guy is so cute, even though he killed.
I don't think it's limited to women. There are those in the
men too
in the gay community that have also an attraction to bad boys.
I'm sure men loved Dahmer too because they thought he was cute too. And I'm just like, yeah. I don't understand.
It's not limited to him certainly. I mean, there's I've never seen a statistic. I don't know how common it is for people to marry someone who is in prison, but I'm sure it's more than one.
There is a whole show called Love After Lockup, where I mean, those people aren't necessarily murderers, but a whole show called Love After Lockup that tells you how many people tend to go to people in prison. It's ridiculous.
So it's a weird. I guess that broader fascination with people who done wrong, people who are, or maybe a desire, maybe a self-belief that, oh, I can fix him or I can change him.
That's definitely a thing. Yep, that's true.
Yeah, and you're not gonna fix something that's innate in those people. Doesn't matter if they're murderers or whatever else. And there are people, obviously, like, there are success stories out of, like, Love, because I do watch Love After Lockup and all of the iterations of that. There are success stories that come out of that. But it's rare, because then there are still the other side of things where there are people who end up attacking the person that they're with. So it's just, it's innate in those people. And when you're talking about serial murderers, that is something that will never change. And doesn't matter how stable they may be, because Ted Bundy, that is what is so fascinating about him too, is that he did have a stable life. He went through life the way a lot of us do. And the whole thing of, well, he doesn't look like a serial murderer. And I do understand that, because he was so put together. He always was, and presented himself well. Again, he was very smart. One of the judges, like, I'm paraphrasing here, but one of the judges said to him in sentencing, you could have done so much more in life, but unfortunately, due to your stillness, like, this is where you're headed. And it's, you could have been an amazing lawyer if you actually put your mind to it and didn't do what you ended up doing. And I actually believe that, because he is a smart person, or was a smart person. But you're not going to change what's just in them, innate in them, which is, they clearly have this desire, to kill. And you're not going to change that.
But yeah. I think there's also a wider, like, we have to believe in the capacity of reform for someone. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily murder, but crime generally. Mm-hmm. Because if you can't reform, then there is clearly evil or. Mm-hmm. You know, awful people who can't be fixed in the world, and that's a scarier prospect. So it's sometimes sort of a safety blanket to believe, yes, we can reform anyone. And equally,
I don't believe
if you can't reform somebody, then does that mean? You know, what is the solution to that? And that's where you get the split between people who believe in the death penalty or people who don't, in terms of what is just. You know, I can understand the wider desire to have people reform, because otherwise it is a scary prospect as to what you do with people who can't be fixed. You know, certainly there's a lot of programs, you know, I mentioned the domestic abuse earlier, that there are specific programs here designed to, that are court enforced, to teach men to confront and not turn to violence and anger and things like that in relationships. Mm-hmm. And you have to believe that those work. Otherwise, we have an unsolvable problem.
Mm-hmm. And that's the thing. I do think, depending on the crime, that you can reform. I mean, it can be a hit or miss for me when it comes to domestic violence, just because.
Sure.
If this is kind of the one time you did this and this came completely out of the blue, then yes, I can maybe believe you can be reformed. But if you've been doing this from the beginning of you being in romantic relationships with somebody, then I don't know if you necessarily be reformed. Even when it comes to murder, if this was a one-time thing and it was, you know, you didn't expect this to happen, you know, I'm thinking like second degree and like lower, then yes, I think.
Or even self-defense.
Or even self-defense. You could definitely be reformed. But as soon as you get into that first degree territory and that serial killer territory, I'm just like, oh no, that's just pure evil. Because I can't understand how somebody can plan to kill another person or just have the mere desire to kill multiple people because you think it will be fun and it gives you this sort of gratification. No matter what that gratification may be, you are getting gratification from doing this. I cannot ever think you can be reformed. Paul Bernardo, if that man gets out of prison, I'm moving. There's just no way that I can ever think that Paul Bernardo could be reformed. Before he started killing young girls, he was raping young girls. So I cannot, for the life of me, ever think that that person could be reformed, ever. And
how long has he been in jail now? Like,
Paul Bernardo, I can't remember the exact year he went to prison. Was it 96, 97? We'll get into it because we are going to talk about him, but. I can't remember exactly when, but he's been up for parole now for a few times and he's been denied each time. And that's, again, the issue that I have with our Canadian system, which we are going to be talking about soon, is our Canadian justice system is so... I understand. And again, it's actually very similar to what I think the UK does, where you don't have, quote-unquote, life in prison. You have 25 years to life, but you're up for parole after 25.
Right.
And I get it, but people like Paul Bernardo don't deserve that. There's other people who have killed for their mere joy who don't deserve that. And that is one thing that I can give the American justice system is life means life. You ain't coming out.
Okay.
And that's what I believe in personally. I don't believe our system should be letting people out after 25 years.
Do you feel like someone can change?
Depends on what you're talking about.
Yeah, like someone like him, like versus, you know, someone that's been short term into a prison. Like, if someone's been in short term in prison, most likely they'll probably kill again. But if someone's been in prison for a long term, I feel like they will most likely change their ways, change who they are as a person. But there's a lot of resources, to be honest, in prison.
Nowadays. I just don't believe and that they, for Paul Bernardo. And yeah, and I can use like Carla Homolka and Paul Bernardo, for example. She got out after 12 years. And I mean, she's living her life. Even though her sister can't, she's living her life, has her kids, got married. And she hasn't, as far as we know, hasn't killed again. And there's a lot of speculation of whether or not like she was more, well, actually, no, not even speculation. It's fact that she was more involved in these murders than she initially led people to believe. But unfortunately, the deal was made. They can't go back on that. And, it, you know, she was in there for a shorter term than obviously Paul Bernardo is currently. But with someone like Paul Bernardo, he is never going to change. He is who he is. And that's never changing. I don't care what program this guy has been in. I don't care what he's done to quote unquote reform. He has, no, he's never going to change. He has not many people. One thing that I'll give to the Canadian justice system is that they will label certain people like Paul Bernardo a dangerous offender. And the chances of you getting out if you're a dangerous offender is slim to none. And even if you're getting out, there is a process of how that looks. It is, it's not just like you're out in the world and good luck. There's a process to that. And I believe Paul Bernardo's actually been out like on day release before, which scares the hell out of me, but I think he has, with people supervising him. Obviously, he hasn't been out on his own. Okay. But that's something that the Canadian justice system will do as well. They will have you out for day releases, and slowly will get you to a place where you're completely out on your own. But the fact that Paul Bernardo has even had day releases, it is not looking good for him staying in prison till he is dead. Because that's kind of the first step into potentially him being fully released. And I don't like it. Because, like I said... Tristan, go ahead.
Tristan, you saying something?
Oh, no. I was just thinking about... I mean, in the context of my podcast, one of the main legal stumbling blocks was the concept of life without parole.
Yeah.
And the... It's splitting hairs a little bit, but the European Convention on Human Rights and how it is applied, it basically says a country can have a whole life tariff. That's what England calls it. And even in Scotland, if you commit murder, it is automatic life. So you are jailed for life, but there is a minimum term set. Mm-hmm. And the minimum has to be served before you would be able to apply for a parole. That doesn't necessarily mean you are going to be let out, but there is still the potential that you could, if you showed evidence that you had reformed or stuff like that. But there are people who do get whole life terms because there is a recognition that no, there is no capacity, or it's so extreme, or whatever. So it's not impossible, but there is still a basic, there has to be a minimum potential that you could apply for parole someday, because otherwise that is classed as cruel. Mm-hmm. Cruel punishment to say no, you're locked up forever. And I can see both sides of it, both sides of that argument, because if you don't have some human rights for everyone, then yeah, I'm not quite sure how to explain it, but do you know what I mean? I can understand both sides of it, but I also, certainly there are some people that I never want to see released. I would be shocked if Paul Bernardo ever got freedom.
Me too.
But I think those are the extreme ones, and you can't come up with a legal system that is based on the most extremes. You have to have one, you have to have a system that accommodates the most extreme, but you don't want to default to that. Because, I mean, you see the stupid system in the U.S. where you've got people who have not committed murder, but under three strikes in California, got jailed for life for three drug offenses.
Yeah, well, which is ridiculous to me.
Yeah.
I agree with that. Yeah. Like, that's... I cannot believe that California has that three-strike rule. And that actually was a storyline in Love After Lockup, where there was a guy who came out and he was on his last strike. And I'm not sure what happened to him, because I don't know what happened. I think he did go back to prison, actually. So that is an extreme, because, you know, I can understand maybe if you're selling drugs, potentially cause someone to lose their life. Mm. I understand it. But also at the same time, that's not like first or second degree. That's manslaughter. And you can still get life for manslaughter depending on the severity. But it also doesn't happen all the time. It's usually less. So I don't know. And I don't want to give too much away from your podcast, Tristan, but that was the thing, like, kind of listening to your podcast and kind of saying, oh yeah, they're not going to send him back to Florida because they had capital on the table. And, you know, but I said, okay, but then you take it off. Like, it's going to be fine. He's going to go back. And that's not obviously what happens. And I can understand, because we've seen it before. This is not the first case where someone has fled the states, especially one that have the death penalty, and been captured in a UK country or whatever, or a European country in general. And they're like, we're not sending him back until death is off the table, because we don't recognize that here. Fine. Great.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that is totally understandable. But the issue that I had with this game, I felt like that was being played by him. Yeah, I understand, you know, maybe under the circumstances, you know, maybe it was a dumb kid making a dumb decision, a really dumb decision by killing someone else. And maybe he shouldn't have, you know, life without parole. I can understand that. But he hasn't served his sentence. He hasn't provided the victim's family justice by doing his time. So this back and forth within the states and Scotland on what is going to happen with him was just, it was angering. Like, obviously the family wants the highest amount of a punishment, and that is understandable, because they took this young man's life. This guy took this young man's life, and I definitely get that. And the ripple effect that causes. But on the other hand, I do get, like, yes, that might have been cruel and unusual punishment, keeping him in prison for the rest of his life. But again, I don't want to give anything else away, but I mean, he needed to serve his time. And the time that he got for what happened in Scotland, that also angered me, because I'm like, that's not enough.
Yeah, I mean, that is a they are very light sentences for that type of crime. I will say, as a interesting crossover, you know Julian Assange, WikiLeaks, he's currently fighting extradition to the US, and his lawyer is the same one who acted for Philip Parkins at the European court level. And actually, I heard one of the lines that he said in court, and I double checked. I went back to episode 5, and it was word for word. Yep, exactly the same words that he used.
I can use this again.
Yeah, well, I mean, it is a
perfect case.
Remember the exact words. It's a flagrant denial of justice. That was the phrase that he used.
Oh my gosh, that's nuts. lawyers, sometimes they're not, you know, creative in their in what they say. And I can say that I work for lawyers. So another serial killer that I don't think deserves any sort of release, or I personally also don't think he would ever be reformed, is Edmund Kemper. Now, again, if you guys watched Mindhunter, you've heard of Ed Kemper. I think actually the first time I heard of Ed Kemper was watching Mindhunter and being, again, fascinated with this person who seemed to have this, he's very manipulative, who seemed to kind of have this very sweet exterior and also very smart and can be somewhat personable, but he is terrifying. This man is reading your kids' books, okay? Like, he's actually, like, he narrates audiobooks. I can't remember which ones for sure, but I think he's done, like, a Star Wars book, too. Like, he's narrated, like, audiobooks, and that's insane to me. But he has that smooth, nice-sounding voice, so it's, like, his voice is perfect for it. But at the same time, it's like, he's a murderer. But let's get into what he did. So, at age 15, he killed both of his grandparents just to see what it felt like. Let me repeat. He killed his grandparents just because he was curious what it would feel like to kill somebody. That's callous. Yeah. Upon release, he drifted picking up and releasing female hitchhikers, but then he soon stopped letting them go, killing six young women in the Santa Cruz, California area in the 1970s. Here's another 70s killer. In 1973, he killed his mother and his friend before turning himself in. So just to kind of go...
Did he even thought about the consequences after that? Or, you know, like, he just...
Oh, you want me to tell you? Somebody. I'm going to tell you. Because this guy is an interesting case. A very interesting case. So, yeah. Let's go into the history a little bit. So, Kemper was born on December 18th, 1948. Okay, so we have a Sagittarius thing going on here. Both Bundy and Kemper are Sagittarius. That's scary. My mom is Sagittarius. And he was born in Burbank, California. So, we have a Californian here. And he was the middle child of E.E., so I guess we're not using his real name, and Carnell Kemper, or maybe that might be his mom. After his parents divorced in 1957, he moved with his mother and two sisters to Montana. Kemper had a difficult relationship with his alcoholic mother, as she was very critical of him, and he blamed her for all of his problems. When he was 10 years old, she forced him to live in the basement away from his sisters, whom she feared he might harm in some way. That is very interesting that his mom felt, let me isolate him away from his sisters because he might hurt them. That's really interesting. Signs of trouble began to emerge early. Kemper had a dark fantasy life, sometimes dreaming about killing his mother. He cut off the heads of his sister's dolls and even coerced the girls into playing a game that he liked to call gas chamber, in which he had them blindfold him, and led him to a chair where he pretended to writhe in agony until he quote unquote died. I don't know about y'all, but I've never played a game like that. Like, that's kind of weird.
That is wild.
Yeah. It's so weird. His first victim was the family cats. That's an indication, honestly, of a serial killer. If your kids are out here killing animals, whether it's your pets or animals, wildlife, whatever, please get your child into some sort of therapy. Yeah. Do not ignore that.
That's an extent to humans.
Because, as a little disclaimer here, we had a mouse in our house. We had a resident mouse in our house for the last week or so. And we were trying everything we could to try and catch this stupid thing to get it out of our house. And my mom resorted to using those sticky traps because it wasn't going in the more humane trap where we could maybe potentially catch and release it. So we had to do this. It finally got on the sticky trap. And I was promptly woken up at 6:30 this morning with my brother telling me, it's on the trap. It can't get off. What do I do? He went outside at 6:30 in the morning and saved this mouse from death. Now that's extreme, but it's at least better than him being like, okay, like, you know, going out there and killing animals or, you know, like a bird, like, you know, killing a bird or anything like that. Like, so if you, that's not normal for children, especially, to go out there and be killing it. Dahmer did the same thing. And it's just like, you can't be going out there and doing that. It's not normal. So if you see your kids doing something like that, like, please get them checked, please.
Yeah.
100%. So at 10, he buried one of them alive. And the second, he was 13 years old. He slaughtered it with a knife. I should do a trigger warning, but there should be a blanket trigger warning at this point. Come on. We're talking about serial murder. He went to live with his father for a time, but he ended up back with his mother, who decided to send his the troubled teenager to live with his parental grandparents in North Fork, California. So, Kemper hated living on his grandparents' farm. Before going to North Fork, he had already begun learning about firearms, but his grandparents took away his rifle after he killed several birds and other small animals. So at least they tried to do something, but were too far gone at this point. On August 27, 1964, Kemper finally turned his building rage on his grandparents. The 15-year-old shot his grandmother in the kitchen after an argument that they had had. And his grandfather wasn't home. But when his grandfather did come home, he shot his grandfather merely because he didn't want his grandfather to find his wife dead. Because he actually got along with his grandfather more than his grandmother. So he didn't kill his grandfather just because I hate you. He killed his grandfather because, well, I don't want him to go in there and see his wife dead. Like, this guy is twisted. He then hid his grandfather's body as well after he shot him. Afterward, after killing his grandparents, he called his mother and he told her what happened. And she told him to call the police and tell them what happened. Later, Kemper would say that he shot his grandmother to see what it felt like I mentioned, and then said what he said about his grandfather, that he didn't want him to find his wife dead. For his crimes, Kemper was handed over to the California Youth Authority. He underwent a variety of tests, which determined that he had a very high IQ. This man is smart, like really smart, but also suffered from paranoid schizophrenia. Kemper was eventually sent to, I'm going to butcher this name, he was sent to a mental hospital, okay? He was sent to a state hospital. And which was also a maximum security facility for mental ill convicts. Which I don't think this is actually said too much, but he manipulated the staff in believing that he was cured. And then he was released. And that's the other thing. Like, and this is still happening even now. But we've had so many cases of people manipulating the system to be like, I'm okay, and that's a narcissistic trait. I'm fine. I'm great. I'm reformed. And they're not. And Ed Kemper was one of those people who did that. In 1969, Kemper was released at the age of 21. Despite his prison doctor's recommendation that he does not live with his mother because of her past abuse and his psychological issues involving her, he did ultimately live with her in Santa Cruz, California, where she had moved after ending her third marriage to take a job with the University of California, which does play a part in his future killings. While there, Kemper attended community college for a time and worked different jobs eventually finding employment with the Department of Transportation in 1971. Kemper had applied to become a state trooper, but he was rejected due to his size. For context, at that time, he weighed around 300 pounds and was a whopping 6'9" tall, which led him to his nickname, I hate this so much. He was nicknamed Big Ed. Mikkel, please don't say anything, okay? He was nicknamed Big Ed.
Big Ed? Really?
I am not kidding you. Big Ed, literally, so for case person, you don't know, we're talking about 90 Day Fiance here. There is a deplorable person named Big Ed on there, who is not big and not close.
Yeah.
Do you realize Big Ed self nicknamed himself that, not realizing probably that he's naming himself after a serial killer? I find that hilarious. It's so funny. Yeah. So funny.
Well, I think Big Ed from 90 Day Fiance, you know, naming himself like in a different way. So.
Yes, because he is not big. He's a much shorter man than Ed Kemper is. But I still find that so funny. I just do. However, he did hang around some of the Santa Cruz police officers. So here's a person who actually ultimately kills multiple people, but he wants to be a cop. And he's hanging around cops. And he built this rapport with the police department in Santa Cruz. Like, they were friends. He was friends with these people. So I want to put that out there. One gave him a training school badge and handcuffs, while another let him borrow a gun. According to Whoever Fights Monsters by Robert K. Ressler and Tom Shatman, I believe. So Kemper, I think that's a, yeah, so Kemper turned to other pursuits with that. He then started to notice a large number of young women hitchhiking in the area. So in a new car that he bought with some of his settlement money, so actually I didn't mention this, he actually got into a car accident. Pretty bad car accident. So with that car accident, he was able to get settlement money. So he used that settlement money to buy a car. So with that, he began storing the tools he thought he might need to fulfill his murderous desires, including a gun, a knife, and handcuffs. He had a murder kit. And if you have a murder kit, it's not looking good for anyone else around him. So it was at this time that the co-ed killer was born. One of the co-ed killers was born. At first, Kemper picked up female hitchhikers and let them go. However, when he offered a ride to two Fresno State students, Mary Ann Pess, I believe, or PC, and Anita Luchessa, they would never make it to their destination. Their families reported them missing soon thereafter, but nothing would be known of their fates until August 15th, when a female head was discovered in the woods near Santa Cruz and was later identified as Marianne Pessy's head. Luchessa's remains, however, were never found. Kemper would later explain that he stabbed and strangled Pessy before stabbing Luchessa as well. After the murders, he brought the bodies back to his apartment and removed their heads and hands. Kemper also reportedly engaged in sexual activity of their corpse. So there's also necrophilia involved in this as well. Later that year, on September 14th, 1972, Kemper picked up 15-year-old Aiko Koo, who had decided to hitchhike rather than wait for the bus to take her to a dance class. She would meet the same fate as the other two victims. In January 1973, Kemper continued to act on his murderous impulses, picking up hitchhiker Cindy Shawl, whom he shot and killed. While his mother was out during this particular murder, Kemper went to her home and hid Shawl's body in his room. He also dismembered her corpse there the following day and threw the parts into the ocean. Several parts were later discovered when they washed up on shore, and he buried her head in his mother's backyard. On June 5th, 1973, Kemper used a campus parking sticker his mother had given him to facilitate a double murder. So like I said, his mother working at the university was going to come into play here. He drove to the university where he offered a ride to two students, Rosalind Thorpe and Alice Liu. Shortly after picking them up, he shot the two young women, then drove past the campus security at the gates and the two mortally wounded women in his car. So someone saw him leave but didn't realize that there was two, at least her women, in the backseat. Or I think dead. After the murders, Kemper decapitated his two victims and further dismembered the bodies, removed the bullets from their heads, and disposed of their parts in different locations. Now, what I do want to say, there is kind of a theme here with him decapitating these women. You are going to see it with the deaths of his mom and her friend too. Use your imagination as to what he was doing with those heads, because this man was absolutely sick, but I think that is important to mention as well. As mentioned, he was doing necrophilia on these victims, which, if you don't know, the definition of necrophilia is basically doing sexual acts to a corpse. So him decapitating. Go ahead.
Why would people do that? Like, I don't understand.
There is psychopathy with necrophilia. And the reason why they do that is because they want to be able to quote unquote rape somebody. But they just also don't want that. They don't want them to fight back either. It's a control thing. It's all a control thing.
Yeah.
There was rumors that Ted Bundy also was a necrophiliac as well. But there's not as much proof with that as there is with Ed Kemper's victims. I think honestly, Ed Kemper, he loves to talk. So he kind of gave up all of this information, which was very different with Bundy. Bundy didn't give up anything that he didn't have to. Obviously, he was claiming his innocence. But there is rumor that he also was a necrophiliac as well. I don't get it. Personally, yeah. I don't. But that's the mirror. It's all. Any person.
Tristan,
do you
get it, Tristan?
Sorry, did I?
Do you get it? Do you understand why people do that?
No.
Necrophiliacs, no.
I've never. I have never attempted to understand that one, and I never will. So
no, I never will. Listen, like I said before in past episodes, if you like to do kinky shit, by all means. This is beyond that, though. This is sick. Like, I don't understand. Yeah. Like, I mean, all of this is sick, but it's just, I will never understand why someone does this and why you want to do that. Like, I just.
I did a class once, many, many, many years ago. In university on representations of the Holocaust, and about half the class really struggled to get through it because they were so focused on the question of why, and I had put that question aside so that I could focus on what we were reading and watching and learning and that kind of thing. And if you were that or umpteen other things, whether it's serial killers or other things, if you are so focused on why, you are going to get lost.
You're
going to
miss the point of it. Of why we're still learning this too.
You're going to struggle to find an answer to why. And you will end up consuming yourself in trying to find an answer to that. And unfortunately, some things in history and life do not have an explanation.
They don't. I think the mere explanation, if we're talking about the Holocaust here, the mere explanation that we can have here is that Adolf Hitler was a man full of hatred, and that's all there is to it. There's nothing more. And why he decided to target Jewish people, you can go back in history. There are answers to that. Dumb answers, in my opinion, but there are answers to that question. That is about as far as it goes. I can understand Hitler's hatred. I can wrap my mind around that. It's everybody else who he was able to manipulate. That is what I can't understand and will never understand. I don't get how you had a doctor, Mengele, out there doing what he was doing. I'll never understand that. Ivan the Terrible, I'll never understand that. Those are just some of the people that comes out of history of this. I will never understand that. And I am not going to try to understand it because, like you said, Tristan, I'll be here forever trying to come up with the answer as to why all of that happened. All we can do is learn from the mistakes, but based on how the world is looking right now, we have not fully learned from our mistakes yet.
I don't think we've learned partially from our mistakes. But I mean, that, bringing it back to the obsession with serial killers, that is, there's in the attempt to understand why maybe some people run towards the programs, the books, the podcasts that they hope might give an explanation of why, so that they can sit back and be like, okay, I know why that happened. I'm not in a similar circumstance, so I'm safe. Or, do you know what I mean? Like, they run towards something that they hope will provide an answer to why, when there isn't necessarily an answer to why hate, or why hate turns to malice, or why hate turns to violence, or hate turns to, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, there isn't necessarily an answer, a quick answer.
No.
Even, which is obvious from from the many hours and thousands of pages of books and TV and podcasts that are produced on single killers or single cases.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. There is, as a woman who consumes true crime, I've taken the position, like, of course, like, initially you're kind of like, why does this happen? Why do we live in a world where people are monsters? But I shifted that to, okay, what can I learn to keep myself safe as much as possible? And you do live in a world where your head is constantly on a swivel. As a woman, I don't go into my car by myself without immediately locking that car. You kind of learn what to do to protect yourself. And I think, especially as women, that is the most I think you can get out of true crime. It's, what can I do to make sure that doesn't happen to me or happen to people that I love? And that's the only thing you kind of have control over. You don't have control over anything else. And honestly, if you do encounter someone who wants to hurt you, the only control you have in that moment is to fight. But ultimately, whatever will happen, you don't have control over. And that's a reality that's hard to kind of, again, wrap your mind around. But that's kind of how I take in true crime, is what can I do to make sure that I'm safe and others are around me as much as I can do.
I mean, we could take more practical lessons on reforming society or reforming the justice system. I mean, there was a whole report after Picton, after the public inquiry into Picton, and I don't know how many of the recommendations were ever achieved, but it certainly wasn't all of them.
Yeah, no, I'm not sure, because I was fairly young when he was arrested, so I don't even... Yeah.
So, I mean, that one, or, you know, even the Truth and Reconciliation Commission is another example. You know, there are plenty of recommendations that can come out of crimes or systemic issues and things like that. And then those recommendations just end up on a shelf somewhere. So, people who might get angry from a program and want to see change simultaneously are either not standing for election or not voting in elections to exact that change or demand that change. So there are practical things that people could take from their obsession with true crime that I don't think happens very often.
No, it doesn't. No, it doesn't. And that's what's kind of good about Crime Junkie, with how they do the storytelling, and that they always kind of have these call to actions. There's not, I don't think, an episode of an Audio Chuck production, which is the where the podcast kind of flies in, and they have other podcasts and Audio Chuck production. There's never an episode that goes by that doesn't have a call to action. And I think that is important in true crime. There does need to be this form of call to action. Even with Morbid podcasts, which is probably one of personally my favorite one that I listen to, there is always a call to action, especially with the ones that are cold case or a disappearance that still doesn't, we don't have an answer to. There is always a call to action. I think that's the most important thing. If you're going to consume true crime, I mean, we all are guilty of consuming it and not necessarily doing anything with this knowledge that we're given. But as long as you're attempting or you're trying to do something, even if it's one case makes you want to try and do something, then by all means, like, that's a start. Like, there is one case in Texas, I cannot remember his name, but I know his first name's Rodney, but I can't remember his last name. But he was on death row in Texas for killing his girlfriend, and he most likely is innocent. He probably did not kill her. They used the fact that they had sex 3 days before and the fact that his DNA was still in her as a reason to say, oh, well, you definitely kill her because your DNA is still there. But chances were that her fiance, because she was in a relationship, she was having an affair on her fiance with this black man, and she's white and her fiance is white, and this is Texas in the 90s, and chances are he was probably, I mean, allegedly he might have been the one that did it, but because Rodney is a black man, and again in the 90s, and we're dealing with this fiance who was actually a police officer as well, they pinned it on him, and he was mere months away from being killed by lethal injection. When I first heard of the story, and again, Dr. Phil was the one that brought this one to my attention, and I remember coming out of listening to this and thinking, he's an innocent man, there's no way they can kill him. And as far as I know, there was a huge call to action, huge response to this particular episode that had come out, and it actually did get a stay of execution. And as far as I know, he is still alive. Last time I checked, and they are kind of trying to figure out what they can compile to have potentially a new trial, because chances are he probably did not have a fair trial in the 90s, so they're trying to kind of get him a new trial. But they did get a stay of execution, so at least there's that. Again, if any listeners who know this particular story and have any update, like, bring it my way, because I might have to do an update, actually, because it's been a little bit since I've looked into the case. But I remember feeling so angry from that I, you know, petitions don't necessarily do anything, but, you know, maybe it can. And I did sign the petition to have his stay of execution, because it's like, there's no way you can kill, again, another black man for something he didn't do, while her fiance is out free and he's not innocent. Even after the death of her death, there was other things that were going on that he was doing, domestic violence and whatnot. Like, there's something wrong with him, and that at least needs to be looked into before you potentially kill an innocent man. So yeah, there definitely needs to be these call of actions if you're going to consume true crime.
Mm-hmm.
But back to Kemper, in March, some of Thorpe's and Lou's remains were discovered by hikers near Highway 1 in San Mateo County. So this is where we're getting into the mother and the friend's death. I'm probably going to go into a little more detail with this than what I have here, but just trigger warning, this is going to be hard to listen to. So in April 1973, Kemper committed what would be his last two murders. On Good Friday, he went to his mother's home, where the two had an unpleasant exchange. Kemper attacked his mother after she went to sleep, first striking her in the head with a hammer and then cutting her throat with a knife. As he had with his other victims, he then decapitated her and cut off her hands. But then he also removed her larynx as well and put it down the garbage disposal. So that is very... He's telling you something with that. He hated his mom so much, and he probably did that because now you really can't speak. Even though I just killed you, you really now can't speak. And the other thing that I want to mention here, and this is where the huge mass trigger warning is going to come in. He not only decapitated her head, but he did, as with his other victims, perform sexual acts on her head as well, which I don't understand that level of just monstrosity, that not only do you kill your mother, but then you also have this weird, again, I don't think it was necessarily that he was sexually attracted to his mother, because I don't think it had anything to do with that. It was more of this control over his mom that he now had that he didn't have before. But I still, it's one of those details with this case that I'm just like, I don't get it, how anyone can do that. And I'm never gonna get it. And that's mm-hmm. okay. But I'm just like, I just, but anyways. So after hiding his mother's body, Kemper called his mother's friend, Sally Hallett, and invited her over to the house. So why he decided to draw her mother's friend into this, I also will never understand. I don't know why he did this, but he did. So when she arrived at the house, he strangled her shortly after she arrived and hid her body in a closet. Kemper fled the area the next day, driving east until he reached Pueblo, Colorado, where on April 23rd, he made a call to the Santa Cruz police to confess his crimes. And at first, the police did not believe that the guy that they knew as Big Ed was a killer. Because, of course, they're friends with him. They built this rapport with him. He wanted to be a cop. How could he ever? Which, by the way, I want to stress, cops kill people too. So it's...
Yeah.
And I'm not talking about, killing someone in the moment of, miscalculation, as we've talked about in the past. I'm talking, they've literally taken the fact they are a police officer and used it to their advantage to kill people.
Police brutality, I'm guessing?
No, that's not... I'm not talking police brutality.
Oh, okay.
I'm talking police officers literally using their badge and their profession to go out and kill multiple, usually women, because they can. And they're able to use... there is a case, I can't remember the exact case, but there has been a case where a cop used the fact that he's in the police cruiser to pull someone over and be like, I don't know, you were speeding, got out of the car, and then they kill the person. Just for their shits and giggles. That's it. They didn't believe him at first. But during subsequent interrogations, he would lead them to all of the evidence that they needed to prove that he was in fact the infamous co-ed killer. So He was charged with 8 counts of first-degree murder. Kemper went on trial for his crimes in October 1973, and he was found guilty of all of the charges in early November. So quick trial with this. When asked by the judge what he thought his punishment should be, Kemper said that he should be tortured to death. He instead received 8 concurrent life sentences. And at present, Kemper is still alive, serving his time at California Medical Facility in Vacaville. So just for those who don't necessarily understand what concurrent sentence means, it refers to the type of sentence judges are able to give defendants convicted of more than one crime. Instead of serving each sentence one after another, so consecutive, a concurrent sentence allows the defendant to serve all of their sentences at the same time, where the longest period of time is the controlling sentence. Mm. So that's Ed Kemper. Again, he is deplorable, as everyone else on that I've talked about or that we've talked about here. He is completely deplorable. I still just don't understand how he is allowed to, I mean, work in prison, do prison type jobs. I don't care. But the fact that he's able to be a narrator on audiobooks, especially children's books, is beyond me.
The children's books?
Mm-hmm. Children's books are the most that he's known to narrate.
It's kind of crazy.
I agree.
But I mean, it's something for him to do in prison, but for him to do, I understand like adult books, but children books, mm-hmm. That's a little something.
Yep, I agree. This is why you should just read your children books the old fashioned way. Mm-hmm. Just in case Ed Kemper is the one who's reading your, reading the book to your child through an audiobook.
Yeah, yeah. What do you think about this guy, Tristan?
I don't recognize him by name, and I don't recognize the case offhand. And maybe that means that I don't. I'm not as much of a true crime junkie as. Right. I don't know. There are cases that I work in news, so I am mm-hmm. bombarded with news cases, and I'm Canadian, but I'm working in the UK, so I actually listen to morning radio in Canada when I'm working over here. Mm-hmm. I find it really relaxing. So I am, and I'm obsessed with stuff going on in the US, so I am following multiple countries, but that also means that there are some cases that I do follow intently, yeah. and there's ones that I switch off to completely.
Yeah.
Because I think you just end up you do have to pick and choose. I know someone who I met in person who said that they were a true crime junkie and listened to true crime podcasts voraciously. But I know for a fact she hasn't touched mine, so I'm not quite should. Sure why. I didn't get an explanation on that one, but you do have to pick and choose, and there's too much media generally, so you have to pick and choose, and so it's easy for me to miss cases entirely.
Yeah, and this is an older one too, and even me, like. Classify myself as a true crime junkie as well. I did not hear about Ed Kemper until I started watching Mindhunter, and that was I think 2018, and that's when I discovered him. Even my friend, who considers herself a true crime junkie as well, who did watch Mindhunter after I had, and she's like, what about this Ed Kemper guy? And I'm like, girl, I'm ahead of you. But I'm like, she like fully consumed him, and she like learned everything about him. She's like, I've never heard of him before. And that is what's, I think, was so amazing about Mindhunter, actually, was like, you learned about people that you never, Son of Sam, never heard of him until I watched Mindhunter. And I'm like, okay, now I'm going to start consuming this, because I want to learn the craziness of these two, especially Son of Sam. Like, guys, certifiable. So I'm just like, I need to assume this now, because I need to learn, like, what am I missing with this? And yeah, and that's, and again, kind of learning about these more older school serial killers, it feels so much safer too, because it's been done, it's been dealt with, they've been caught. So it feels safer, I guess, to kind of learn about them. Even like Jack the Ripper is like, well, he's long dead, you know, even though they didn't catch him, he's dead, so it's fine. Like, it feels safer to talk about those. It's the ones that are still more, that are current now, that I'm just like, oh god, like, that scares me. And the potential of them potentially getting out of prison too is what also scares me. I think Son of Sam is dead now. Ed Kemper, like I said, is still alive, but he's never getting out of prison. Like, he's stuck there. He's never getting out. But one of those people, like I've mentioned, that scares the hell out of me, that could potentially get out of prison, let's jump in with Paul Bernardo and Carla Homolka. This is the last one we're going to talk about. So this crimes of serial rapist and murderer Paul Bernardo and his now ex-wife Carla Homolka, particularly the 1990s sex slayings of teenagers Leslie Maffey and Kristen French, were among the most horrifying and controversial in Canadian history, and we're still in it. So before he became the murderer that he is, he started off being the Scarborough rapist. So around 1 a.m. on May 4th, 1987, a young woman was attacked and raped within minutes of getting off a bus near her home in Scarborough, a suburb of Toronto, if you don't know that. So this was one of a series of up to 24 rapes or attempted rapes that took place over a five-year period. The targets of the man called the quote-unquote Scarborough rapist were teenage girls and young women. Most of the attacks happened outdoors, but in at least one instance, the perpetrator actually broke into the victim's home. So the attacks were accompanied by beatings, intense verbal abuse, and dire threats to discourage victims from going to the police. On one occasion, a uniformed Toronto police officer staking out a bus shelter actually spotted the suspect hiding under a tree and pursued him on foot. But as I think we can all gather, he did escape from that. The investigators twice questioned Bernardo, actually, who lived in his parents' Scarborough home at the time, but they were satisfied that he was not a likely suspect, which is so irritating. But as a matter of routine, they took samples of his hair, blood, and saliva for DNA testing against specimens found on rape victims' clothing. And they did nothing with it, because he didn't do it. That's what so just blows my mind about this case, is that you had his DNA and you did nothing with it. That could have potentially saved three young women from being killed by him. So DNA testing was new in Canada at the time, and the Center of Forensic Science in Toronto had only one qualified scientist and one technician to go through DNA. With samples taken from dozens of men questioned in the Scarborough rapist case were among 50,000 collected at that time by police investigating numerous cases across Ontario. So the death of Tammy Homolka, which is Carla Homolka's sister, on December 23rd, 1990, Bernardo, who was 26, was engaged to Carla, who was 20, and was living at her family's home in St. Catharines, Ontario. That evening, while Homolka's parents and younger sister, Lori, were asleep, Homolka and Bernardo drugged the youngest sister, who was 15 at the time, so that Bernardo could rape her. Homolka participated in and videotaped the sexual assault of her sister. Early in the morning, on December 24th, Tammy, who was still unconscious, vomited and stopped breathing. Bernardo and Homolka dressed Tammy and carried her to a bedroom. They cleaned up the crime scene, hid the video cassette, and called 911 emergency number. An ambulance took Tammy to St. Catherine's General Hospital, where she was pronounced dead. So they would go on to say that this was like an accident. They did not mean to kill her. Bernardo definitely used this against Carla later on too, because he was quote unquote in love with Tammy. He's a sick freak. But yeah, he would say that, and he would blame Carla of her death. They're both to blame for this, obviously. Niagara Regional Police questioned Bernardo and Homolka particularly about an unusual burn mark that was found on Tammy's face, but they again accepted Bernardo's explanation that it was a carpet burn Tammy had sustained when he dragged her to the bedroom. The burn had actually been caused by an anesthetic called halothane administered to Tammy on a cloth pressed over her face. Doctors concluded that Tammy had choked to death on vomit after overindulging in alcohol. So also to preface, because this isn't mentioned here, the anesthetic that was used was gotten, well, Orla had gotten a hold of it because she was actually working in an vet clinic, and they would use this to put dogs, obviously, to sleep so they could do like surgeries and stuff like that. So that's where she was the one that got it. And again, this didn't do the proper investigation to kind of figure all that out. So Leslie Maffey's murder is the next thing we're going to talk about. On February 1st, 1991, Bernardo and Homolka moved into a bungalow in Port Dalhousie, Ontario. They were married on Niagara on the Lake on June 29th. That same day, boaters and fishermen at Lake Gibson, so the same day that they got married, the fishermen on Lake Gibson, which is south of St. Catharines, discovered concrete blocks that encased human arms, legs, feet, and a head. The next day, another man found a human torso floating in the water. The remains were identified as those of Leslie Maffey, who was 41, and she lived in Burlington, Ontario. Her parents had reported her missing on June 15th. When police undertook the investigation of the Maffey murder, Paul and Carla Bernardo were honeymooning in Hawaii. That's just great. Almost a year later, in April 1982, Niagara Regional Police sought help from the American Federal Bureau of Investigation, FBI. An FBI group of criminal profiling experts produced a psychological portrait of the murderer as a sexual predator who would probably kill again. So that is exactly what happened. So the thing too with the Maffey murder that is, like, again, I don't want to victim blame or blame the family or anything like that, but she had actually gone to a friend's wake because she had recently had a friend who had passed away, and she had a curfew, strict curfew. She lost track of time, got home late, doors were locked in her home, and she asked a friend if she could come over and stay with her because her parents had locked her out of the house. That friend unfortunately said no. I guess her mother or father didn't want her staying there, whatever. And that is how Paul Bernardo found her, sitting on her yard. And yeah, then we can kind of put two together on that one, which is very sad with that. But she didn't, there's conflicting reports on if she was kind of a rebel child and stuff like that, but from what I've heard, like, she was a typical 14-year-old kid who just unfortunately lost track of time that particular day after going to her friend's wake, or was a funeral. I can't remember if it was a funeral or wake. And that's, unfortunately, the friend group would ultimately have to go through another loss again, and her family had to go through a loss, and it's horrific. What happened with her. And then the final murder that happened was Kristen French. On April 30th, 1992, a female body was found in a ditch along a rural road in the north end of Burlington. The face was battered and the hair had been shaved from the head, but an old injury, which was the missing tip of a left pinky finger, immediately told investigators that the corpse was that of Kristen French, who was 15 at that time. French's parents had reported her missing on April 16th. A shoe identified as hers was found in the parking lot of Grace Lutheran Church, which she had passed by every day going to and from school. Then a witness reported seeing a scuffle in that parking lot on the afternoon of the 16th. It had appeared to the witness that two people were forcing a girl into a car she described as a cream-colored Chevrolet Camaro. Police searched the parking lot and found a torn fragment of a map of Scarborough and a lock of brown hair. They began an exhaustive check of cream-colored Camaros following what turned out to be a mistaken lead. Nardo actually had a gold-colored Nissan, not a Camaro. So acting on a tip that Bernardo had a penchant for violence and aggressive sex, police interviewed him on May 12th and once again dismissed him as a prime suspect in what were now being called the two schoolgirl murders of Southern Ontario. What more do we need to do in order to get this guy in prison? Like, this is ridiculous. Maffey's remains were exhumed and medical examiners found bruises on the back that had similarities to the blunt force injuries on Kristen French's body. So for the first time, police connected two murders at this time. Niagara Regional Police, working with the Halton Regional Police, established a special task force to conduct the investigation into the two crimes. On July 21st, a reenactment of French's abduction was shown on TV, and it generated thousands of tips, but none were substantial. So we're kind of at the point now where they've captured him, the help of Carlo Gamoca, obviously you got her palladial, and we're heading into trial now at this point. And we're going to kind of talk more about how he was declared a dangerous offender. So jury selection for the Bernardo trial began on May 1st, 1995. The Crown opened its case on May 18th. The trial lasted 4 months, during which Homolka spent 17 court days in the witness box. Bernardo was found guilty of all charges against him, 2 counts each of first-degree murder, kidnapping, forcible confinement, and aggravated sexual assault, and also 1 count of committing an indignity to a human body. That was most likely for the dismemberment of Maffey. So he was sentenced to life imprisonment and declared a dangerous offender, making parole highly unlikely for him. So again, as mentioned before, life in prison here in Canada means 25 years to life, but with him being marked a dangerous offender, it basically means that he will never most likely get out of prison. Fingers crossed. So 5 years later, in 2000, both the Ontario Court of Appeal and the Supreme Court of Canada turned down Bernardo's efforts to appeal his murder convictions, because yes, this man tried to appeal. In 2006, Bernardo's lawyer said his client had confessed in 2005 to 10 additional sexual assaults. Since 2013, he has been incarcerated at the Millhaven Maximum Security Prison in Bath, Ontario. And if you're wondering why just since 2013, because he was originally in the Kingston prison, now been shut down. You can go there as a tourist, actually, if you want to go and check it out. But it's no longer in operation. The other thing, too, that was interesting about this case and the reason why Carla Homolka should never have gotten her plea deal as well is when the tape... So there were tapes involved. They had obviously been filming these sexual assaults. Not the murders, but the sexual assaults. And they had found the tapes. His defense counsel found the tapes and never turned it in to the Crown.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
And I believe his counsel was obviously, I think he was disbarred if I'm correct, but I do remember. But yeah, they held on to those tapes. For what, I don't know. I think they were kind of hoping we have guess what, guys? Carla Homolka is more involved than we thought she was, but all that did was derail the case. So it just ridiculous. But anyways, so in terms of the aftermath now, the Bernardo Homolka crimes, apart from their impact on the victims and their families, had a wide ranging impact long after the trials concluded. The videotape showing the rape, well, and I guess they say the murders of all of the victims, were ordered to actually be destroyed. So they are not in existence. And even in the trial, the only people who were allowed to witness these tapes was the jury. Media was not allowed to even see it. They could hear it, but they couldn't see it. And from my understanding from watching this, some of the jurors were forever affected by what they had witnessed on those tapes, and then they were later destroyed, so no one can get access to them, which is probably for the best. Homolka, after she had been released from prison, lived on in Caribbean island of Guadalupe under the name Leanne Bordelis, along with her new husband, which I'm not going to bother even say his name here because he's this is ridiculous. He was the brother of her prison lawyer, Sylvie Bordelis. Yeah. Yeah. And her then three children also. She has three kids with this guy. In 2012, after being discovered in Guadalupe by a Canadian journalist, Homolka returned to Quebec, where she is currently residing. But she is being thoroughly harassed, from my understanding, once they realized who she was. She looks very different now. And she has no relationship with her family. They completely disowned her, which I would do. Paul Bernardo became eligible for day parole in 2015 and full parole in February 2018 after having served 25 years in prison. However, in October 2018, his application for both day and full parole was denied. So actually, he didn't even on day parole at all, by a panel of the Parole Board of Canada after only 30 minutes of deliberation. Took no time. As the dangerous offender had mentioned, Bernardo will likely never be released. So I've kind of gone in depth here in terms of like why people tend to be really obsessed with true crime, in particular serial killers. And I decided to kind of find out why is that? Like, why do we have that fascination? And many argue that this fascination for serial killers stems from an evolutionary subconscious desire to identify potential threats, which I did kind of mention in my experience. It helps us explore and engage with the darker side of the human psyche while still enjoying the warmth and safety of our cozy living room while watching or listening to a podcast. And you're just like, okay, like I'm safe in my space while I'm consuming this. Mm-hmm. Do we agree with this? I do.
I think that makes sense on... Yeah, on a few levels. I think we kind of touched on that a bit, that it's, you know, recognizing, okay, so this person did this, that's not similar to my life in ABC ways, so therefore I'm safe. But I also think there is a morbid fascination that people, you know, in the same way as people slow down when they go past a car crash. That there is a human fascination with death, with suffering, with whatever. And you see it in the reference was in relation to the U.S. Supreme Court, but there was a phrase dubbed a while back, the cruelty is the point. Mm. And there's a whole subsection of people, many of them in charge, who really enjoy either causing or watching other people suffer.
Yeah.
Even more so if it's a minority that you've identified as a worthy target. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that I think plays a part in our obsession with true crime as well.
And kind of to piggyback off of that as well, like the human nature of being wanting to witness death or whatever, it's kind of goes back to even the old school days of like being present during someone's execution. You know, I think of the Salem witch trials, for example. Anytime someone was, you know, being hanged or whatever, there was always an audience, right? People who you may or may not even know watching this and I hate to say this, but enjoying it. And that kind of just also lends to like, what is wrong with us too, that we're okay to kind of watch someone's death, especially then. Like now, it's something that doesn't happen now, but you know, if you do, as family members or whatever, the victims' family members who may watch someone be put to death, now, like, I do understand that, but that's not open to the public, whereas before it was. Anyone can go see an execution happen. And I've always thought about that too, kind of with this. It's interesting. But the final thing too that I'm going to say here is, why in general are serial killers so popular? And serial killers have become pop culture icons, which is gross. Or they can also be referred to as celebrity monsters, which, I mean, at least you have a monster in there. But anyway, since the 1970s, with some of the people that I just discussed, serial killers may appeal to the most basic and powerful instinct in all of us, which is survival. Again, there is this human tendency to empathize with all things good and bad, including these unremorseful serial killers, which I think if you are going to consume true crime, especially talking about serial killers, try to not identify with them. Unless you yourself have something going on in you, then that can be what happens sometimes, obviously. But if you're just a normal everyday person who doesn't have this need to do what these people do, try to identify with the victims. We have to remember to not forget the victims in these things that happened to them, that they didn't choose for this to happen. They didn't choose to be someone's victim. So with that, like, we have to try to remember them and the life that they had and what they could have offered the world to. And that unfortunately gets stolen from them because of these, not just serial killers, but just murderers in general.
Yeah.
But that's it for me. Again, before we close out, I do want to say thank you again to Tristan for coming on. Again, I'm going to stress everyone, don't walk, run, and listen to A Murder Without End. I think it's an incredible podcast. It's a very interesting, very different story of a true crime case. And I highly recommend it. Maybe we can put links to the podcast on our show notes as well. And if you want to hear more from Tristan, he is going to be coming back for a couple more episodes too. So we're going to hear more from him in a little bit too.
Definitely.
Tristan, do you have anything else you want to plug?
No, but I will add that the podcast won 2 Signal Awards last year, and
I noticed that.
We are currently shortlisted for 2 True Crime Awards as well.
Amazing.
It's and if people want some of the extra resources, I mean, I link to it after every episode, but tomorrow.is is my website, and that's got the extra resources, links to all the cases, an opportunity to donate if people feel inclined. podcasts don't generally make money. So
no, they don't.
But thank you very much for having me on and letting me talk about it.
Absolutely. And
justice in general.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. So this ends episode 26 of the Next Tape Podcast. The Next Tape Podcast is available now on all podcast platforms. We also have a website called solo.to/nexttapepodcast. Where else are we at, Tanika?
We are on Facebook and Instagram at Next Take Podcast and Twitter and TikTok at Next Take Pod.
Okay. We also have a email. Contact us at mikeltanika@gmail.com. So in today's episode, we talked about a whole lot of things about, you know, true crime.
Yeah.
In general. And we also have a special guest, Tristan. Once again, thank you for coming on this episode. We're glad to have you for the next like 2 or 3 episodes, I believe.
Yeah, he's going to be coming on every other week for the next couple of episodes that we're going to be doing. So you'll hear from him again in a couple weeks.
All right. So thank you. Thank you, Tristan.
Yeah. Great. Thanks again.
All right. Okay. So I'm Mikel. And
I'm Tanika.
We're out until next week.